Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Each weekday morning, Roundtable host Joe Donahue is joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature selections from these conversations. On Wednesday, December 17th, Joe was joined by specialist in government and public services healthcare consulting Azmat Ahmad, Executive Vice President and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Bard College and the Director of their Center for Civic Engagement and a Professor of Political Studies, Jonathan Becker, Founder and Academic Director of the Hannah Arendt Center for Politics and Humanities and Professor of Politics, Philosophy, and Human Rights at Bard College, Roger Berkowitz, and Albany Law School Professor and Director of the Edward P. Swire Justice Center at Albany Law School, Sarah Rogerson.
The President announced a complete blockade of sanctioned oil tankers to Venezuela. In a Truth Social post, President Donald Trump also declared the government of President Maduro a foreign terrorist organization. This is a total and complete blockade of all sanctioned oil tankers entering or leaving Venezuela, a dramatic escalation in the months-long pressure campaign against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. Such a blockade, which Trump revealed Tuesday evening on Truth Social, could devastate Venezuela's already struggling economy, which depends on overseas oil sales, primarily to China and often on sanctioned vessels. Venezuela is completely surrounded by the largest armada ever assembled in the history of South America, Trump wrote. It will only get bigger, and the shock of them will be like nothing they have ever seen before. Until such time as they return to the United States of America, all of the oil, the land, and other assets that they have previously stolen from us. Trump declared the Venezuelan regime a foreign terrorist organization, FTO, and accused government officials of using oil to enrich themselves and finance drug terrorism. The step further escalates the pressure Trump has imposed on Venezuela as the U.S. tries to push Maduro to leave the country and threatens military action in Venezuela if he does not. That from the reporting from The Washington Post. Jonathan Becker, we'll start with you.
Yeah, it's, I think when we look at what's going on, first of all, I would say when you change the name of the Department of Defense and call it the Department of War, then you get a war. I think you're realizing what has been predicted before. I think this underlines the fact that the attacks on Venezuela are not about drugs, which has been the claim up until now, and that they're about assets and oil and who may control them. I think most importantly, it's a reflection of this new national security strategy that Trump announced, the administration announced at the end of November, which takes the focus off of Russia and China and looks at global balances of power and focuses on the Monroe Doctrine and what they call the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which is focusing on U.S. asserting its power within Latin America and in this hemisphere, and focuses on things like supply chains and access to resources. So I think it's a sort of a naked description of where the United States foreign policy is heading. And I think that we are in danger of not simply what will happen vis-a-vis Venezuela, but what will happen if Maduro actually left and what would happen to the country then, which is something which we're not talking about.
So when a lot of this seems, I guess what I'm having trouble with is how much did we sort of like scratch the itch here, like in the sense of that we're antagonizing to a bit to further the interests.
Well, look, I mean, I think the Trump administration operates on symbols, and this is a great symbol of, you know, the new America, which doesn't care about things like rights. We care about power and access to resources. So I don't know whether that would, I don't know also whether this is linked to the fact that the Epstein documents are meant to be released on Friday. It's a wonderful distraction. But it seems to be, if you read the national security strategy, it is aligned with that. It is aligned with what they're saying that we will do, which is assert authority over this hemisphere and place an emphasis on access to resources and supply chains. And that is what is going on. So I think it's much more dangerous. I would also say the descriptions of America First, which did not suggest a projection of American foreign policy abroad, seem to not be realized through the actions there. So I think it's, you know, you want to have, as I was saying, the Department of War, what's called the Department of War, it's really the Department of Defense, wants to have, you know, some type of thing it could hold up to show that it is new business and it's the new Trump administration. And I'm afraid we might get what we claim we're seeking.
It's also an anti-socialist agenda. I was listening to some other commentary from The New Yorker, and the phrase, the way to Havana is through Caracas. The idea that the relationship between Cuba and Venezuela is so close, and Venezuela, of course, supplies a lot of oil to Cuba, that it's a state, it's, there's, there are two other, there are two things going on here, at least. And the idea is anti-socialism and aggression in a place that seems like an easy win for the Trump administration on that front.
I also wonder about the designation that has been given, the FTO. What does that mean? And what does that allow the administration to do? Because the attack on the boats was a very thinly veiled action, as we can now see, in terms of having that much power just off the coast of Venezuela, certainly signaling to the government that the United States was there, present, active, armed, and ready to intervene. And now we're seeing these next steps. So I'm also thinking about what that means and what that next step will be once Maduro, as well as other parties, have been given this designation. What does that allow the president to do legally as the next step?
Yeah. Roger. I think there's two parts that we've talked about. One is the policy part. And I think Jonathan is really right to set this up as part of the new U.S. policy. And, you know, people can go, oh, my God. But the truth is there's a rational policy here, whether you agree with it or not, right? To focus not on China and Russia and things you can't control, but on smaller countries in our and break the world up into spheres of power. This has very much been the argument of those who've been against our intervention in Russia and Ukraine for years, saying, look, that's Russia's, you know, sphere of power. Taiwan might be China's sphere of power. And there is a rationalist, realpolitik view here that, you know, is changing U.S. policy. And I think people are not talking about that as much as they should. And they're talking more about the sort of international law and humanitarian claims, which are not unimportant, but I think in the end will pale compared to the real shift. The other side of it, which, you know, is where I think is even more important, is what, you know, we are seeing here, not only in foreign policy, but in the United States, a revolution in process. And Trump represents a revolutionary class. It's a coalition of anti-bureaucratic, you know, bureaucratic bourgeoisie allied with a kind of resentful petite bourgeoisie and a plutocratic elite. It's a weird mix, but that's who they are. But what they're really against is a class of lawyers, journalists, professors, regulators, institutional actors who are meant to safeguard legitimacy. And so I think of the Trump administration as an anti-legitimacy revolution. They saw their exclusion from cultural power as illegitimate, and they believe they're the rightful elite and resent anyone who will limit them. And legitimacy is simply a mask for the domination of our class, the global elite. And this is a revolution going on. And the Pete Hegseth entry into the military and the Department of War, or whatever you want to call it, is an attempt to say that the norms of professionalism and human rights and that you have to follow rules are a kind of imposition and domination by a global class of legitimists. And we're going to return to a different version of America. And it's a real version of America, which hates institutions when those institutions seem illegitimate and take away the sort of rough and tumble of American democratic ideas. And we have to understand that we're seeing a revolution going on in the country and not get distracted from that by the day-to-day barrage.
When it comes to the day-to-day barrage, I mean, how much of this also is I don't want to be cynical, but it does seem to be time to be a diversion too, doesn't it?
Well, every day is another diversion. So,
right.
I mean, the sort of flood the zone idea, you know, is a diversionary thing, but it's also part of what's going on, right? They want to, if you just keep people talking and flooding the zone every day with more and more excrement, you lose sight of what's actually happening, which is that institutions are being delegitimized. And let's be honest, the institutions were biased and were corrupt, and there's a reason for this happening. And that's why it's so hard to fight it, because you can't just say, let's go back to, you know, the old institutions, because people don't trust them. You have to be willing. The only way to fight this is to some way try and somehow build a consensus around rebuilding new institutions, and that's going to take time.
Jonathan? I mean, I would say some things are being surrendered, right? The Senate and the House are not playing the roles on the check on the Trump administration. I just wanted to pick up on something that Roger said. There's real, you know, I've wanted to say this, Russia has, we have the Monroe Doctrine, Russia has what's affectionately known as the Minsky Doctrine, right? Which says that we control this former Soviet space, the 15, geography of the 15 republics which constitute the former Soviet Union. So if you're Ukraine, this is incredibly meaningful because it is signifying, you know, this shift in strategy, which gives the United States control over one part and Russia control of another part. And I think, as you signaled, Roger, Taiwan also very significantly, you know, I would be scared to death if I was in Taiwan right now with this new version of the United States. But I also think, you know, I don't want to give a pass to the folk in the Senate and the House who consistently have surrendered their role as a check on this administration's policies, perhaps because they agree with them, but I'm not sure. I think there's such divisions going on there, but there's certainly a lack of heart. And regardless of whether we can't go back to what existed before, I do think the very absence of checks and challenges on the current administration is incredibly corrosive on a whole host of issues that we'll see come to bear in the coming months and years, I'm afraid.
Yes, the rugged individualism and American exceptionalism that started really, I mean, the Tea Party, but before that, since the beginning, since the founding of our country, but that's run amok now. And because we played such a strong leadership role post-World War II in establishing international rules of conflict, this is also a sign that the United States is rewriting the norms for international engagement. And if you're not on our side, the rules will be used against you. The rules will be crossed and redefined in order to exclude you from the global power structure.
Let me add one thing, though, which I would say, which is that the administration isn't stupid. I think Venezuela is, you know, they're a great target. If you look at amnesty, if you look at Freedom House rankings, mm-hmm. not free, they're incredibly low. There's oppression going on there. If you look at Transparency International, they're amongst the most corrupt regimes. So if you're going to choose a foil to exercise a new version of national security strategy, they're a target, although we hear nothing about talking about once Maduro leaves, if he leaves, right, which is an assumption on their part. And Susie Wiles really, you know, as I think maybe you said that, gave it away yesterday. She said, we're going to keep on blowing up boats until Maduro cries uncle. And people way smarter than me say that he will. Well, I don't know if he will. That isn't his MO. But if he does, what happens next?
Jonathan Becker on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, December 17th. We'll be back with more after this. Thank you. Welcome back to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. On Thursday, December 18th, Joe Donahue was joined by Ulster County Board of Elections Commissioner Ashley Diddis, Professor of Political Science at Hartwick College in Oneonta and co-director of the Institute of Public Service, Laurel Elder, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead Anna Markowitz, and Associate Professor of Music at Vassar College, Justin Patch.
There's a new study out revealing how Taylor Swift reflects America's deepest political and gender divides. It's a newly published article in Social Science Quarterly revealing how attitudes toward global pop icon Taylor Swift have become a lens through which to view the political and social divisions shaping the United States. The article is Mirror Ball Politics, How Taylor Swift Reflects America's Partisan and Gender Divides. Political scientist Laurel Elder of Hartwick College, our guest this morning, is one of the authors of this study to analyze national data to examine how partisanship and age and gender attitudes shape public perceptions of Taylor Swift. Those of us who say that we talk too much about the day-to-day politics and not enough about pop culture, both two things together, here we go. I just want to know, what's happening in your life that you think, oh, that's what I want to, that's what I want to look into?
I will tell you. So this all starts during the pandemic when I was slowly losing my mind. And the only thing that kept me going was that Taylor Swift released Folklore and then Evermore, two albums in 2020. And they were like my emotional lifeline. And then fast forward a couple years later and my daughter's turning 13 and I think, we have to get to the Eras Tour, no matter what. And we did. We saw them in Philadelphia in May of 2023. It was amazing. And but of course, I'm not just a Taylor Swift fan. I'm also a political scientist who studies public opinion and gender. So the whole time I'm at the concert, I'm thinking, this is just amazing. I'm like, everybody knows Taylor Swift. Everyone has feelings about Taylor Swift. And there's all these reactions to her. So I'm like, I'm wondering, like, I want to get a hold of public opinion data about Taylor Swift and see what people think about her and what the determinants of public opinion are and what this tells us about the state of American politics and society. And that's what I did.
I apologize for interrupting, but just the fact that there is data on that indicates what a big deal she is.
Well,
right?
I mean, here's the thing. My colleagues and I were at the American Political Science Association conference, which hosts about 5,000 political scientists once a year. And there was this firm called Verisite, a polling firm, and they had a booth. And they said, if you come by our booth, you can get a question on our national survey, because it can cost $150,000 to do a national survey. And so we'd been talking about this idea until but it was only one question per person. So we had to get a group of researchers together. And we got on a question about Taylor Swift, a question about hostile sexism, actually a couple questions. And and so that's how we did it. So that was the triumph.
So the term mirror ball politics, what is it?
Okay,
what does that mean?
Your listeners who are Taylor Swift fans will know that that is the name of one of her songs.
Yeah.
One of my favorites. That's the argument that we're making in this piece, that public opinion about Taylor Swift actually is a mirror to some of these gender and partisan divides in our society. And we just talk about how views of her reflect our deep, you know, polarization along party lines. It reflects the gender gap, particularly among young Americans. And it also shows the really strong role of hostile sexism in our society, that women who are prominent in cultural or political spheres face this. It's a really real force in American politics.
Is that overt sexism based on her gender or based on her success or both?
Well, I mean, this term hostile sexism is, you know, researchers have said there's actually different kinds of sexism. And hostile sexism is the idea that people are resentful of they think women have gotten too much power and they think that women have gained power in society at the cost of men. So women are making gains, but this means losses for men. So there's different questions that kind of tap this, like some things like, do women complain too much about things at work, being treated unfairly at work. That's one of the measures, for example. And anyway, so it really is. I think it's both. We see it as being a strong force about women who have positions of power. And here you have Taylor Swift. She's very successful. She is, you know, really working hard at, you know, owning her own music and, you know, autonomous in control of her own music. And I think this, so a lot of people will say, I don't like Taylor Swift's music. And I think a lot of people just don't like her music. But some of it is because there's resentment against powerful women in our society.
Well, you don't have to like everything, certainly, but it is interesting in the study of how, when it comes to Gen Z, it also shows this this gender divide.
Yeah,
and that's fascinating to me because that's something obviously that's being passed down.
Yeah, yeah. So what we see is that there's been a gender gap in American politics. Pretty much consistently since 1980, a pretty modest size with women being a little bit more liberal and democratic than men. But a lot of polls have shown that it's quite large among young Americans, under 30 is usually how they define it. And that was on display in the 2024 election. We saw, you know, women being pretty progressive and young men drifting in a more conservative direction. And that same gender divide is apparent in terms of views on Taylor Swift as well. We see a huge partisan gap, too. That's one of our big, that maybe is not surprising, but like Democrats tend to like Taylor Swift. Republicans tend not to like Taylor Swift. And to some extent, you know, pop music used to be a place where people could come together. Republicans, Democrats enjoy the same music, have some fun together. And what we're seeing now, Taylor Swift is just one example where, like, people, it's like a marker of your political identity now. And there's, you know, fewer and fewer common spaces where we as Americans can come together and, you know, find common ground.
I've seen this woman perform twice, and I've gone with my nieces both times, and the power that she has over the audience and them and what they see in her and what is reflected is I've never seen anything like it. It is so profound and really cool, quite frankly. But I did notice during the campaign, this past campaign, where there was this little kerfuffle over, you know, her backing a candidate and who she was going to back politically, that seemed to put more pressure on her than anyone else would have had of being a pop music star.
Yeah, there's a couple of things there. I think I framed it kind of negative that there's like this, you know, hostile sexism and some people that's driving some people to not like Taylor Swift. But you point out the impact that she's had on, did you say your nieces?
Yes.
Young women. I think it's been very powerful and very positive, making them feel confident and feeling like they can do things and be independent. There is I've done research on role model effects, and I think it's a positive thing. There in many ways. But also the pressure is on her because she has reached she was well known, but then with the Eras tour, it's just like went to a different stratosphere. It's like Beatles, it's like Elvis. There's like when she had I'm sure you saw the news coverage of this, when she had a concert in a city, it would actually affect the economy of that city. You know, it had such a powerful impact. So I think few people reach that level of fame. And so with that, I do think comes a lot of responsibility. And so I think when she endorses a candidate, it comes under a lot of scrutiny. That said, I would say her music overall is it's not very political music at all. I think some people are disappointed in that. But, you know, and she comes from country music. She's gone a lot of different genres. So it's just like her music itself is not that political. But yet she's become a political symbol. Yeah.
Can I just put one note in on Taylor Swift? Well, I'm going to talk about the other part of pop culture that men love is football. And that she is engaged to a guy who's a Hall of, probably bubble Hall of Fame tight end.
Yeah.
And yet in that relationship, She's the big cheese.
Yes.
So if you are a guy who's into traditional masculinity, mm-hmm. whew, that's rough. You would think if you're potentially Hall of Fame tight end with two Super Bowl rings, that you would be the guy. Except that, no, that's not the case. And I think that twist adds a little something to what Laurel was saying.
I think early in that 100%. In that relationship, people were saying, "Well, all they do in the television is show her in the luxury box." And one of the commentators, I believe it was Jim Nantz, said, "Well, we have found that when we don't do that, we get so many complaints from both women but men who are very upset that they're not seeing how Taylor is reacting to a given play on the field." I mean, it's interesting to watch. The other thing, doesn't it also, and this is where I can potentially get into trouble, but isn't it, because this certainly isn't, I don't think sexist, it's just true, but someone to reach that level of success and not be a train wreck. Like, I mean, doesn't that say a lot to, I mean, she herself does an amazing job, but she has also managed incredibly yes. well. I mean, that is a business, and it is a very, very, very astute. They do it extremely well, which I think often is a rarity.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's what, you know, I liked her music, went to the show, and it was just phenomenal. I mean, we've all gone to concerts. They usually start late and all this. She's just started. She had a countdown clock. It started exactly when it was supposed to start.
Yeah.
On the note. I mean, she did all these costume changes, but did them within like 45 seconds. So, you know, you were just never, you know, waiting. It was so professional. It was so amazing. But I know people who have worked on my cousin has friends who's worked on tours, and the people working on her tour like love it. Everyone wanted to work on Taylor's tour because they are treated so well professionally. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they said it's not like that on the other tours. It's like she is a good business person, without a doubt. She knows how to run a very large and complex organization.
Yeah, you know, I saw Taylor Swift in this tour, and I saw a Coldplay, and I was struck by both of those artists. Of being able to have 70,000 people in a stadium and make you not feel like you're a part of a group of 70,000 people, like actually speaking to you and having it be a very intimate experience, which seems to be an impossible thing to do, and yet they do it.
The other thing I'll say about Taylor Swift in sports is that the whole, there's an incredible amount of pressure both in 2020. And 2024 about like when is Taylor Swift going to endorse somebody? Is she going to endorse Kamala Harris? All that sort of stuff. At the same time, you've got the shut up and dribble stuff in, you know, post George Floyd, right? And so I find it interesting that like there's a whole wing of people that are like, if you're an entertainer, just shut up and entertain. Except that like if you're Taylor Swift, like if you're not participating politically, you're doing something wrong. And I think, you know, having done music and seen what it takes for people to succeed, you don't have a lot of extra time. And so the expectation for her to be political is, to me, it's like people want to hear their values spoken through the biggest microphone. And for a lot of people, Taylor Swift is the biggest microphone. Mm-hmm. And that reflects something about how small people feel. And to Laurel's point about democratic values, about how people don't feel like there are democratic values because their voice doesn't matter. And so you take recourse to the biggest microphone saying what you want to say because you feel like nobody's listening to you.
And for the candidate, for that person who's being endorsed, they obviously want that audience, right? I mean, they want a piece of that pie.
Although studies have shown that celebrity endorsements count for very little. But
yeah.
I think it does make people feel better when they hear their thoughts reflected on the largest possible stages, which I think is just a sad moment in society when we're dependent on somebody else to be our own mouthpieces.
I do wonder if like there was a shift in her listeners after she endorsed Kamala Harris, because I was actually a little surprised that she did, because she was dating this football star. It seemed like she was kind of trying to, like, bridge the gap, like, bring everybody together. We can all love Taylor Swift. And I bet there was some blowback after she endorsed and did a whole, like, I'm a cat lady too moment. But on a personal note, this makes me really want to talk to my two teen and preteen boys about why they don't like Taylor Swift. Before, I thought it was just because it was like a lady pop star. Like, I don't expect you to listen to Ani DiFranco either. But like, is this like a gender statement? Because ladies are bosses too, and you need to be okay with that. So
check on the boys.
I know.
Well, I mean, what's interesting when we were researching this piece, because I was like, you know, trying to find what other music, what other articles have been written about like partisanship and music tastes and things like that, and the there are and gender, and this was my point that this may or may not surprise people, but if you like ask like a guy like show me your playlist, it's like almost all men on the playlist. And if you ask a woman show me your playlist, it's like 50-50. And I think you see the same with like books people read, who are the authors you're reading, things like this. And so that's just like a broader question. Like, what is going on in society that men listen to overwhelmingly male artists and women listen to both women and men? So, I mean, your sons are reflecting broader trends, something that's going on.
You say in the report, popular entertainment used to be a common space where Americans could come together and have some fun. Those shared spaces are shrinking, and with it, the opportunity for connection across partisan divides.
Yeah, I think that's true. And we're seeing this, I mean, in terms of so many facets of, like, you know, what car you drive, what kind of clothes you wear, what kind of neighborhoods you live in, and just this kind of, I mean, Robert Putnam, you know, probably a lot of people are familiar with him, a Harvard political scientist, and just talked about Bowling Alone. It's just like there's these spaces where people with different views would come together, whether it was the bowling alley or the Taylor Swift concert or whatever it might be, are just shrinking among us. And I think that's a sign. So once again, it's like Taylor Swift didn't cause these divisions, but she is like reflecting them back to us in a particularly powerful way.
Well, I think like the death of monoculture in our society has really fostered that environment. All but except for Taylor Swift has been the only person in the last 15, 20 years that has punched through that. The internet has sort of siloed us off. We used to all watch the series finale of a TV show all at the same time because that's when it was on TV. Now with streaming, you can just pick and choose when you're going to watch it, when it's convenient for you. As a fellow Swifty, I am now obsessed with you, and I would love to read this study. This is something, you know, these kinds of studies are what sticks with people. I studied international relations, and the Big Mac Index is what is the one of the few things I remember from college. When you connect it to things that young people care about, or just, you know, all people care about, I think that that's what will stick with people, and the message is so awesome. You are awesome. That is really cool.
You were making an interesting point at the break, Justin.
Well, what I found sort of anecdotally just among my colleagues and sort of coworkers is that millennial guys are way more okay with Taylor Swift than younger men. And that seems to be what Laurel's article looking at younger men seems to play that out, that she becomes a much more divisive, I hate to say that she's a divisive figure, but one that is exemplifies certain gender divides among younger men, not among men who are in their late 30s and early 40s.
Right.
Yeah, and I do think this feeds into this broader conversation that's been having when we saw young men drifting, you know, towards Republican partisan identification and voting for Trump in larger numbers in 2024. The manosphere, you know, the idea that there's a lot of conservative podcasters out there that young men seem particularly drawn to, and there's some evidence coming out now that like young men have more like traditional attitudes, are becoming more religious, have more, you know, in terms of gender roles, more traditional than millennial and older generations. So I think you're maybe seeing that reflected, and your comment speaks to that directly.
Laurel Elder on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, December 18th. We'll be back with the final segment of this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, after this break. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. On Friday, December 19th, the Roundtable panelists were Ulster County Comptroller and former President and CEO of the Community Foundations of the Hudson Valley, March Gallagher, Senior Fellow for Health Policy at the Empire Center for Public Policy, Bill Hammond, and Senior Fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Robert Pondicio.
We didn't talk about this yesterday, and I think it is, I do believe it's worth talking about as it comes to the control of Congress. Johnson says he still controls the House. Some fellow Republicans disagree. This is from the Washington Post. Following a year of guiding an unruly House Republican conference to legislative victories, there are signs that Speaker Mike Johnson is losing his grip. For the fourth time in recent weeks, a group of frustrated Republicans banded with Democrats to try to force a vote on legislation that Johnson fought to keep from reaching the House floor. Tensions boiled over Wednesday when four moderate Republicans, scorned by Johnson's decision to withhold votes on their health care proposals, joined all Democrats in muscling the House to vote next month on a bill led by Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries that would extend enhanced Affordable Care Act tax credits for 3 years. With the House adjourning for the year on Thursday, Johnson is downplaying tensions among Republicans that for months he had tamped down with the help of President Donald Trump. On Wednesday, he insisted that he has not lost control of the House. But some of his colleagues are beginning to question that. House Republicans' narrow majority has tested Johnson's hold on the Speaker's gavel since he unexpectedly ascended to the job in October of 2023. Johnson often finds himself in the middle of warring GOP factions, taking his time to decide what a majority of his colleagues would support and hoping that an opposing flank does not spark a rebellion.
I would not want to be him. He's in such a challenging position. I mean, he continues to have Trump support, which is amazing. But, you know, I read one Republican member who basically said, you know, the fact that they blocked the moderate Republican amendments led to the Democratic bill now reaching the floor. It's legislative and political malpractice. And I have to think most of the conference probably does feel that way. You know, they don't want to see Democratic bills reaching the floor and being supported by the American people. So this really is sort of elevating Jeffries' bill and I think making a lot of people unhappy. I also thought it was funny to see people saying that, you know, Massey wouldn't vote for puppies, you know, that he's been so cantankerous. He's not one of the four Republicans that voted for this, you know, so... Yeah, Johnson is in a really, really difficult position, but I don't think they're going to find the 9 votes to get him out. They would need 9 Republicans to make a change, and I just don't think they're going to do it. They don't want to relive the Kevin McCarthy era when you couldn't get anything done, and they had those weeks and weeks of leadershipless House. I think having a leader like Johnson in charge of the House doing nothing is more palatable to them than having a leaderless rudder. So I think we're going to see it continue the way it is for a while.
I think we in the media and maybe the American public as well have sort of schizophrenic ideas of how Congress should work. On the one hand, we want it to be bipartisan and we want people to work across the aisle. And on the other hand, we expect the partisan speaker to have an iron control. Like we resent it when he exercises his iron control, and then when he doesn't have iron control, we make fun of him. Like that's sort of what's going on here. And of course, it is super narrow majority that effectively gives a handful of members the ability to hold the whole institution hostage, right? Like if I don't know what the exact number is, but apparently it's 4. Right? If 4 Republicans are willing to break ranks with the Speaker and give their support to something the Democrats want, that's enough to shift the whole debate because it's so narrowly divided. You're not going to get a strong Speaker in that environment. You know, and in addition, he was elected under these rules in which it's easier to remove him than it had been traditionally. So he's got to be aware of that. That's exactly what happened to his predecessor. So I don't like it's a tricky job. I don't know. I'm not close enough to it to know whether he's doing it well, handling it well. He But I'm not surprised that he's running into troubles like this because it's just inherent to the situation.
It's almost as if we're on the eve of midterm elections or something.
I know,
And members have to consider their own, you know, prospects back home. Oh, wait, we are on the eve of the midterms. Gee, that must be part of it, right? Look, the story here, to my mind, I'll defer to my fellow panelists who are more close political observers than I am, but it's a math problem, right? It's just arithmetic. It's a narrow House majority. There are deep internal divisions, frankly, within both parties, and a midterm electorate that historically punishes the party in power. So it should surprise no one that certain members of the House are going to be, you know, looking to their own narrow self-interest going into 2026. But, you know, don't discount the fact that the Democrats face some of the same issues as well. You know, they face pressure from their left that can complicate efforts to present themselves as a, you know, sober centrist policy going into 2026. So I guess I'm surprised that we're surprised by any of this.
So go ahead.
I was, you know, when Biden won and had majority in both houses at the beginning of his term, I was incredibly frustrated as a Democrat and somebody who's obviously very active in Democratic politics with the slowness of getting anything done. I just wanted to beat my head against the wall. Like, can't you get this infrastructure thing done, right? And I'm still frustrated at how, you know, it did get passed. I'm frustrated at how slowly it went. The money did not get out on the street before the next presidential election, which is a huge mistake. But when I look back at the major pieces of legislation that passed during the Biden administration, right, the American Rescue Plan, the Infrastructure and Jobs Act, the CHIPS and Science Act, the Inflation Reduction Act, like, we actually got stuff done. As mad as I was, as slow as it was, as horrible as it was to get it done, this Congress is doing nothing. Except for the big, beautiful bill. That's it. That's all we've had.
So since I'm a health policy guy, I should talk a little bit about the substance of this fight that we're talking about. Had to do with these enhanced tax credits for people buying health insurance. Something like one, I don't have the percentages in my head, but there's a certain percentage of Americans who buy their health insurance through the Obamacare exchanges. These original ACA tax credits made it more affordable, and the enhanced tax credits added to that. They're due to expire at the end of this month, just a few days away. And there's a dispute within the Republicans about whether they should extend those tax credits. Mm-hmm. There's some Republicans, they're called moderates, who are worried that if they allow them to expire and don't do anything to restore them, they're going to pay a price for that at the polls, so the midterm election coming up. And they had like a Republican version of extending the tax credits. They wouldn't be as generous as they had been, and they would have anti-fraud measures and stuff like that. But Mike Johnson didn't want to take a vote on that policy. I guess the majority of his conference probably did not support that policy, and he didn't want to have them forced to take an up or down vote on that issue.
And there was a shutdown over this, for pity's sake.
You don't want your members to vote against extending the tax credits, but they don't want to vote for them either. Right. That's the kind of dilemma Mike Johnson faces on a lot of issues, where they don't want it to happen, but they don't want to vote against it. And then there were four members, one of whom is from New York, Mike Lawler, who signed the discharge petition. So that sort of forces a vote that they don't want to take. That's the political embarrassment. But it only took four Republicans to make that happen. And it's all about healthcare, folks. it's all about how much we should be spending on our health insurance and how we should be financing.
Can you remind me the ACA? What does the first A in that stand for again?
Affordable.
Oh, okay, that's right. Whatever happened to that?
Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was the original name.
Okay, so it's not the SCA. It's not the Subsidized Care Act. It's the Affordable Care Act.
That gets to a debate about what affordability means. Does it mean making the thing less expensive inherently, or does it mean
for someone?
When can I make my joke that the president hadn't heard of that word before?
Affordability?
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people are talking about affordability.
Yes.
I think if we got the profit out of healthcare, it would go a long way to making it affordable.
Yeah, it sounds great until you decide that, gee, I don't want to be in this business anymore if I can't make a profit.
Well, there is profit in healthcare, but a lot of that profit is flowing to the doctors and the people that we want to make money in healthcare.
So, Bill Hammond, not to put you on the spot, but where are we when it comes to healthcare now? I mean, nothing is moving forward, obviously, in this Congress. They're headed home. So we look to calendar year 2026. Where are we? Is there still seems to be talk that, okay, something needs to be done. We'll figure out what that is when we get back.
We are in 2021 or the early 2021. So we were, by letting these enhanced tax credits expire, we're rolling back the clock on to the policy that existed before the enhanced tax credits were passed. They were passed as a pandemic response
during COVID,
measure.
Right.
They were made temporary. That's why they're expiring. So if the status quo in 2020, 2021 wasn't perfect, but it wasn't a catastrophe either, and we're going back to that. Now, for individual families, there are certain people who are in a situation where they're unsubsidized or they're losing all subsidies, or their subsidy is getting smaller, and that will lead to an increase in their costs. Some of them may, in fact, decide it's too expensive and drop their insurance. Those are not, I don't know how to phrase this. Those are uncommon situations. Most people either get their insurance through their employer or they're eligible for Medicaid or Medicare. In New York State, the number of people affected by this is 0.6%. Mm. It's 140,000 people. I don't want to dismiss that. That's more than the population of Albany. But it's an exceptional situation. And they're not like having their health care ripped away. They're just having their subsidies are being reduced. And it will be painful for them, no doubt. And in some cases, they will just not be able to afford their health insurance.
We're going to see healthy people leave the pool.
Yeah. Having complained about the politicization of everything, now I'm going to have to do it, Bill, and just ask you, I'm curious your answer, what's the right move for the Republicans here? Because it feels to me as if they're between a rock and a hard place. In other words, the fact that these have to be subsidized proves the point that the ACA has not had its intended effect, but they don't want to be the Grinch and oppose those subsidies because that will cost them in the midterms.
I'm a believer in incrementalism when it comes to healthcare. So you want to move. You have to not overly disturb the existing system, but move it in a better direction.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea that was on the table that actually some Republicans have put forward, which was to extend the subsidies, but to reform them. Mm-hmm. There has been an issue with fraud as a result of these enhanced subsidies because it creates a situation where some people don't have to pay a premium.
Mm-hmm.
And you had brokers enrolling people without their permission, collecting a commission on their insurance, and they weren't paying a premium, so they didn't realize they were enrolled. That's the nature of the fraud. So one of the proposals was just to eliminate the zero premium plans. Seems like a reasonable approach to fixing fraud. That would be my instinct is to gradually modify the things that you think are going wrong.
But am I wrong to think that if we extend the subsidies that we will have yet another shutdown or threatened shutdown, next time this comes up? In other words, unless you ratchet them down or do something like you're proposing, you're just kicking the can down the road, right?
Well, you don't have to make them temporary. You don't have to have
make
an expiration
permanent.
Date. You can leave it up to the future lawmakers to decide whether they want to continue them or not, but you don't have to create a deadline by putting an expiration.
And work on an alternative plan. Look at all this energy that went into Project 2025. That should have been spent, that energy and time should have been spent on how do we reform healthcare in the United States. That would have been a good use of energy.
But I should express at least a little bit of sympathy with the point of view that because healthcare is like a fifth of our economy. It's close
mm-hmm.
to that.
Right.
And it's growing.
Yeah.
And there's some good reasons why it's growing, but then there are also not so good reasons. And it part of the problem is that we haven't figured out a way as a society to say no when somebody wants a service, we don't want to say no to that. And then when the provider wants to get paid, they can set whatever like they can almost virtually set their own price. Yeah. I mean, the providers are probably gritting their teeth when they hear this because they're constantly fighting with insurers and Medicaid and Medicare. But if you just look at the bottom line, the amount of money we pour into healthcare just keeps going in one direction, and
it's not sustainable.
But your expertise, not mine. That's because there's nothing. There's no downward force on prices.
There's no
right?
effective downward force.
This is what we see. And I've talked about this before in the roundtable with student loans. In other words, if you forgive them, there's no reason for colleges to lower their price. Same dynamic here, right?
Very similar. Okay. Yeah. And it's partly a result of the subsidies. The subsidies are kind of deflecting the pain so that it's basically we're borrowing all the money.
Is there a way to transfer some of the cost of the subsidies onto the providers? Because that would be my answer for student loans is, sure, do student loan forgiveness, but it's got to come out of the hide of colleges and universities, not the taxpayer. Making public policy here on the fly on the round table.
So the arch conservative point of view on this is that we should get away from insuring everything and have people pay directly for care. But care, that'd be very difficult to get to because of how expensive care has gotten under the subsidized system.
Yeah.
Sort of like asking people to suddenly pay their entire tuition bill without any financial aid.
Wait, I did exactly that.
Yeah, some people still do. But it's getting rare.
We're making it rare.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
because the majority of people wouldn't be able to go to college if that was the approach that we took. So
yeah, just we're making it rare. Who's making who is the they? Who is the we in that? We are making it rare.
No, in other words, if we continue to subsidize, look, I'm almost making a devil's advocate argument here because I don't have firm opinions about this. But subsidies are not free, right? So what you're doing with the subsidy is you're not lowering the cost, you're transferring the cost.
Yeah, and the unfortunate thing is that we're transferring it to future generations because we're borrowing so much money. So and you see a phenomenon where the state lawmakers, they think the federal government should pay for everything because they understand that it's not it's not real money. It's monopoly money. It's paper money. And even you hear it from members of Congress saying, well, why shouldn't we spend more? We're just borrowing it. The mentality is
I mean, let's compare the cost of the subsidies to, the cost of the tax breaks for, extremely wealthy people in the One Big Beautiful Bill, right? To me, one is outsized. And that's the tax break. So I push back on that and say, to me, the subsidies benefiting, I think it's 24 million Americans who are getting the subsidies, 24 million Americans versus a very small group. So it's about the distribution of wealth and how we address that.
Linda writes to us and says, having worked for 37 years for a not-for-profit healthcare provider, some of what the panel just said literally scares me to death. The cuts that are coming with the affordable plan coming to an end will possibly bring an end to some of these hospitals. True or false, Bill Hammond?
I think there's a lot of apocalyptic thinking about these cuts. I mean, like I say, we're going back to the status quo that was 4 or 5 years ago, that the various institutions of healthcare were not dying then, and I just don't think it's going to be the catastrophe that some people are portraying.
He's right.
I hope you're right. Yes. I think generally people must hope you are right.
We all hope no, there's no catastrophe.
Melissa writes, it is so nice to be able to have the ability to afford decent education. The system is damaged due to the fact that people who are hoarding money at the tippity top of this disgusting trickle-down theory are doing just that. A government that respects the right to life and the pursuit of happiness for all their people does not subsidize the wealthy. That from Melissa. Now we go to Matthew. Your panelists are taking the view of the upper middle class and the owners of our society. Everyone can afford what they need if only They would use their willpower and pay their fair share. This is nonsense. We need to borrow from the future to create subsidies. We can tax the rich to pay for subsidies. If we want everyone to afford health care, we can also make health care cheaper. And there are ways, whether the health care is government provided or provided by the market, it is always regulated. And there are ways to regulate it so that there is downward pressure. It's done in other countries. Every other civilized country has some form of socialized health care and spends less than they are putting up false choices and then saying, oh, well, we have to make a more market choice and people will somehow afford it. This is just the argument of the ruling class. I, just for the record, added the periods in that because otherwise there were none. Go ahead.
I think people have a misconception about our healthcare system works. It is heavily socialized. Mm-hmm. In New York State, something like 40% of the population is on either Medicaid or the Essential Plan, which are fully socialized health plans. And then there's a whole other chunk who are on Medicare, which is a largely socialized health plan. It's the number one expense that the federal government spends money on, borrowed or otherwise, is health care, Medicaid and Medicare. A lot of that money, to the extent it's not borrowed, a lot of that money is coming from wealthy people paying taxes. We have a progressive tax system. Maybe it's not as progressive as some people would like, but we do tax wealthy people more than we tax low income people. And also our healthcare system is not as dramatically different from other countries as we often think. The original idea of Obamacare, which was going to be a mix of public and private plans, had an individual mandate in it. That was going to get us very close to the system in Switzerland, I think it is. But the individual mandate was extremely unpopular. And it didn't even, like, it was a mandate in theory. It didn't have a strong enough penalty. That is kind of the psychological hump I think we have to get over as a country, is the idea, do we want to require people to have health insurance? Mm-hmm. And if we're not willing to require them, are we willing to let them kind of flounder when they don't have health insurance? But until we get over that psychological hump, we're never going to quite get to the idea of universality that exists in other countries. We have a version of universality in the U.S., which is a elaborate safety nets. I think a lot of what that letter writer says is how we do things right now, and it's not that different.
I can't believe the letter writer saying that about the whole panel, since I'm sitting here saying deprofit healthcare, tax the billionaires. I guess, you know, maybe they didn't hear what I had to say on that.
Marge Gallagher on the Roundtable panel yesterday morning. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at WAMC.org. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, and for Madeline Reynolds, thank you for listening. Thank you.